Good afternoon. We're going to open the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. For the record, today is Monday, February 21st, 2005. I'm Representative Greg Smith. We have Susie Jordan with us. Cat Bell, our subcommittee assistant. Oh, there it is. Today we're going to be finishing up a public hearing on House Bill 5069, Oregon Department of Transportation. And I don't know, Susie, are you going to start out on that, or do we want to have the director, Director Warner, come up?
I'll take a minute to explain the meetings you have in front of you, and then Bruce, you can go ahead and come on up. You'll be. What was passed out at your place are several materials. One is the answers to the questions from Thursday's hearing, and it looks like this sheet. We won't be going over this, so I just wanted to point that out to you, that that is sitting at your place. And then there are three clipped handouts from the agency in answer to questions that we asked them to be prepared to respond to today. So they will be working from those documents. And a copy of the letter or memo we sent them making the request is there as well, so you can see what it is we asked for. With that, I'll turn it over to
Director Warner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Let me just again briefly tell you what I think we're going to do here and who's going to do it. What we're going to do is first cover the first piece of paper you have in front of you, which has to do with the allowable uses of revenues for the department to address, I think, some of your questions. Mike Marsh and I will do that. We were then going to move into an update of where we are on the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, the status of that, and Mr. Tindall and myself will go through that. And then finally, today we'll have an opportunity to go through our revenues and our expenditures and where we are in terms of our overall financial planning, because I know there was questions about our ending balance, our cash flow, and Mr. Marsh and I will be available to do that. So with that, what I'm going to do is first off call your attention to the very top, I think, which is a chart that is entitled Oregon Gross Revenue 2005-2007. And what we've attempted to do here, and as a result of questions by the committee regarding the uses and flexibility of specific sources of funds that we have proposed in our 2005-2007 budget, my staff has taken some time and put together this table that tries to identify the various revenue sources and their use, and then arrayed them into one of three columns to help you understand the limits and the flexibility of any of those specific revenue sources. I think, as you know, as we got into the review and as I went over our priorities and reductions, we got into specific questions about revenues, and I know some of these you'll understand, but it was clear to me that additional information and clarity was needed to help you folks address your needs, which was what was mandated, what's committed, and what is flexible in terms of the uses of those specific fund types. So that's what we've attempted to do. So as you listen to Mr. Marsh when he goes through the three columns, I guess the thing I would just encourage you to look at is column one is identification of those revenue sources which are the most flexible. And what that means is those are the sources of revenue that you as a legislature have the authority to essentially change statute and redirect those funds for other purposes. On the other end, on the third column over, are those sources of revenues that are not flexible because of limitations by the Oregon Constitution, federal appropriation limitations, or federal law. And those in the middle, which is obviously the most majority of the funds, are dollars that, although limited for highway and transportation, do have some limited flexibility within the highway and transportation expenditures. This is where we talked about you could, again, do more expenditures in DMV, as an example, and less in bridges, or you could do more in pavement preservation and do less grants to local governments, as an example. I do want to, before I ask Mike to get into this, is just make it clear that the governor's recommended budget has made those trade-offs and recommendations, and spends. Yeah, there's use these sources of money where the governor and we believe they should be spent. But I think to fully understand our budget and address your questions about flexibility, I thought this table could really help. So with if that's helpful, what I'm going to do is turn over to Mr. Marsh and actually walk through these in a bit in detail, because I think it is important to understand the various funding sources, where they come from, and what's flexible and what's not. Okay, good.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marsh from ODOT. And again, as Bruce indicated, this is the sheet we're looking at. It says ODOT gross revenue 2005-2007. And I kind of apologize for the fact we're going to be going through, in essence, line item detail here, but because of the importance of understanding each one of these revenue sources, we thought it'd be worth the time. And if I'm going too slow or I know there's too many people falling off, I'll try to take that into account in my speed and pace. What we are doing here, as Bruce indicated, is trying to lay out for you the degree of flexibility in the funds. And as Bruce indicated, in essence, as you move to the right, you have more strength and dedication in the funding. Starting off with the left column there, headed by statute. Obviously, statute is up to the legislature to change, and so the legislature has that alternative to do that. Moving over one to the right is Oregon Constitution or federal law. Obviously, there are ways to make adjustments in the Constitution, but it does require an additional degree of control that occurs there. And then finally, on the right side, federal law, appropriation, and Oregon Constitution, which is specifically dedicated for a particular use, which would require changing the Constitution to or the other adjustments in order to make any movement there. So we'll start down through the listing. And, Mr. Chair, the first one is motor fuel taxes, and I'll just take a moment to describe each one of these, and if there are other questions, I'm happy to go into it. This, of course, is, in essence, our gas tax, our largest revenue source, and is the $820 million that's shown in the middle column over there, which means, as we discussed, that it's dedicated to transportation uses by the Oregon Constitution, not individually to particular transportation uses.
Have parameters actually, can you send this committee the parameters on what constitutes transportation uses and what does not?
Mr. Chair, I would point out, I think it was middle of last week, you asked for the latest Attorney General's opinion on the use of the Highway Trust Fund monies, and I think that was part of a packet which really does outline the limits and expectations of the Department of Justice on that matter.
About a half inch thick, and we can certainly pull back out that back out again.
Perfect. Thank you.
Sorry. The second one is aviation fuels tax, which goes to the aviation department, and that's for those fuels taxes that relate to aviation and therefore are appropriately used for under the statute for projects and other things under the Department of Aviation. And that's the $5.4 million, which is shown as Oregon statute controlling its dedication. The next one is snowmobile fuels tax, which is not a registration fee, but is a fuels tax on snowmobiles. And you can see it's over on the far right-hand column. So this is the first one showing the strongest degree of dedication. And right after that is the ATV, or all-terrain vehicle fuels tax, which again is not a registration fee, but goes to the Parks Department under the current provisions and is dedicated by the Constitution for that. Next is a boat fuels tax, which goes to the Marine Board, and that is transferred there under statute, so it's $11 million. That transfers the money to the Marine Board, and they use it for facilities, boating facilities, to get in and out of the water, enforcement as well as education. Non-highway fuels tax, this is the Transportation Operating Fund, which is, some people have called it the lawnmower fund. The greatest component of it has been called the lawnmower fund. And the revenues come into ODOT as part of the gas tax, but we make an estimate through a process of economic analysis to determine how much is used for snow blowers, leaf blowers, lawnmowers, all the other different kinds of equipment that uses gasoline but does not operate on the highway. And that money is put into the Transportation Operating Fund, and then is used to apply, has been determined by the legislature, to apply to different expenditures which have been allocated over the last couple of years since it was established. Those relate to senior and disabled transportation is the biggest use, but there are a lot of other uses that were part of that constitutional analysis that was done by the Attorney General 3 years ago that allocate money for the DMV drug testing program, the motor program at DMV, as well as several other functions that are part of the Department of Transportation that do not have a dedicated revenue source. So sometimes during discussions, it's called the Transportation Operating Fund. Other times it's used a colloquialism of the Lawnmower Fund. Moving on, non-highway fuels tax is the one we just completed, and we're moving on to the weight mile tax. Weight mile tax is the largest source of revenue coming from the trucks. This is mainly for the larger trucks above 30,000 pounds up to 105,500 pounds. The fact is that this is collected through our weight mile tax process with auditors reviewing the amount of payment. And that's the largest source. The other source is truck registration fees, which is used in place of weight mile tax for a component of the trucks. And that's both those are listed in the middle column, so they're dedicated to transportation uses, but not specifically to one element of our budget. The next is the road assessment fee, or road use assessment fee, which is done, not to get too technical, but it's done on a basis of a one-trip, non-divisible haul for trucks that are at a sizable weight, in other words, about 98,000 pounds and above. And they pay that one assessment fee on the part of their load where they are hauling the item, and then on the back haul, when the truck is basically empty, they pay regular weight mile tax. So this is a specialty assessment fee on the basis of heavy loads, and it comes in as a constitutional dedication for transportation, not to specific uses. The IFTA administration fee, or International Fuels Tax Agreement, I'll say that again, International Fuels Tax Agreement administration fees, this relates to the fact that our process of making sure that each state monitors and regulates the use of vehicles on a consistent basis. We're part of an international fuels tax agreement that makes sure that we pay into that, and then anything that comes up in terms of trucks coming through our state, our trucks going through other states, are handled on a consistent basis mm-hmm. between states and provinces. Pack and load fee is a very small amount, $68,000 there, which relates to motor carrier regulation of small commercial movers. The dealer business fees and penalties are...
Really quickly, I have a question, Senator.
Thank you. Do you have any sense at all, Mike and Bruce, what the cost of collecting $68,000 would be? I mean, that is so small. I wonder if the cost of collecting it is smaller, is greater than the...
There's been a lot of debate about the regulatory function there and where it should be or if it should happen, and if the center is interested in some more information, we can look it up.
It just strikes me as it is a very, very small amount collected, and what would be the effort to collect it?
We'll track that.
Unless it's really an enforcement issue, and I have no way of knowing, but...
It is an enforcement issue, but it's economic regulation is what it is, and we'd be happy to have a brief, maybe one pager that kind of updates the situation there.
While we have a pause, I have a question. Do our truckers pay a motor fuel tax in addition to the weight mile tax and truck registration fees, or does one supplant the other?
No, the weight mile tax is their method of payment. They do not pay a motor fuel tax in addition to that.
So when they share with me really quick. So when they pull into the truck stop and they fuel up, are they getting? They're not paying tax at that point in time.
That's correct. That's in the states that have a diesel tax, where the trucker would come in and pay a large tax to the state. That's how they would do it. But in Oregon, we have a weight mile tax, and so it's not recovered when they come in and fill up at the station.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, you got trucks coming through the state that aren't registered in this state, and you got intrastate and interstate trucks. I mean, how does all this, between the road use, the truck registration fees, and all that, how do we account for all that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, the quick answer is that the International Fuel Tax Agreement works with another group called the International Registration Plan, and those two together, between states, they monitor the amount of miles in each state, and if an estimate by a trucker is that they were going to drive X amount of miles in Oregon, and the audit at the end of the period, they audit at least 3% of the trucks, and then make assumption beyond the audit of those 3%. And if there is a change from what they had expected that those folks would drive, then that money is actually transferred from one state to another. Mm-hmm. So if a trucker ends up driving more in California than they thought, and less in Oregon, and Oregon had received the tax, Oregon would pay California to that extra amount. So it is balanced through this international agreement.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, moving on then to, we just started on the dealer business fees and penalties, which relates to car dealerships and the fact that there are at times penalties that occur as well as fees that occur by those car dealerships, and those revenues come into ODOT. Vehicle licenses are the significant piece of revenue that you're used to seeing in terms of regular vehicle licenses for cars and other and trucks and other small trucks, that is. It's a sizable piece of money, and again is dedicated by the Constitution for the full almost $370 million. Recreational vehicle licenses, those are transferred, those revenues are transferred to parks, and that is done per the Constitution. Snowmobile licenses are in the snowmobile fund and similarly are dedicated in that far right revenue source, but do get dedicated now, so that that is quite a restriction. The next one, though, is talking about the custom license plates, and the next three are dealing with license plates, and there's quite a bit of complexity there. I'll start off and be open to any questions that you may have. The first one are custom license plates, and that the acronym there is Environmental Quality Information Fund. And the, in essence, deals with litter pickup, and that's where the revenue goes. These are the what some people call vanity plates, or where you can determine your own six letters or whatever you wish on a license plate. They're not the kind of plates that come with a salmon on them or some other kind of picture on it, but it's the one where you designate the letters, and the revenues from that comes into this fund and is dedicated only by statute.
Mike, let me ask a question following up on Senator Morris's earlier question. Can you send us information on the expense of offering custom plates, salmon plates, special group plates as it relates to the revenue that we generate?
Yes, we can show our costs and revenues.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, I recall a bill that we, I think, passed out of the Senate last session that simplified the specialty nature of these plates. But I lost track of it. Did it ever materialize?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, there was a bill that some would say simplified, and I think that really it was the intent is to limit the number of special plates. Mm-hmm. So there is that, and there was essentially some requirements that if you want to add a new special, or I guess a special group plates is the right term, you essentially need to have remove another one. So there's some limitations on new plates. You know, like Crater Lake or like the salmon plate, and really trying to look at steering folks towards the group plates. But it's to get to some of the issues we're talking about in terms of the administration, the cost, and trying to simplify the way we utilize the plates. And I can't remember the bill number, but if you're interested in that, we can send that to you.
No, I don't need it. But, Mr. Chairman, I guess, did it become law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, it did become law.
Yeah.
So it did help control the total number of plates that could be out there at any one time, although it didn't change the process internally much.
When you're providing that information, can you also send us a little bit of breakdown on the profits that are generated by the different organizations who are, I guess, the benefactors of these plates?
Yes, we can, Mr. Chair. The next one is the salmon plate line, and that's dedicated for parks and the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board. And those are the standard salmon plates that one thinks of. The other specialty plates, like the universities, Oregon State University, University of Oregon, Crater Lake, Cultural Trust plates, all those are in this line, which also is statutorily only dedicated and shows the revenues we receive from those types of special plates. Moving on to the driver's licenses, these are standard driver's licenses, which are received as revenue to the department and are dedicated in the Constitution to transportation uses. The Student Driver Training Fund is dedicated in the Constitution for driver's education and safety functions, and now that is done through the Department of Transportation, working through outside providers. The motor safety or motorcycle safety fees funds motorcycle endorsement training, and that's $1.8 million, which again is dedicated in the middle column there. ID cards, in essence, deals with cost recovery and transfers the funds to transit for the Surface Transportation Fund program. And the point here is that it's dedicated by statute. ID cards are not something that we absolutely have to do, but the reality is people do need some kind of ID, and with the moves towards stronger enforcement and regulation around identification, we'd expect that there'll be a continuing expectation of ID cards being required in some way. But again, it's just dedicated by statute since it does not deal with the highway fund. Vehicle trip permits are one-time trip permits when somebody is going to not get a license and get authority to haul something or to drive for a certain period of time on one trip. That's $8.3 million, and that is dedicated in the middle column. Recreational vehicle trip permits are transferred to parks, and those are over under the far right column, so more dedication there. Snow park permits, which is for snow removal in snow parks, is just in statute, so it's in the near column.
Can you share with us really quick, back on the money that's transferred to the parks, how the agreements work between the Oregon State Parks and the Oregon Department of Transportation in terms of your department recovering the cost associated with your part of the activity?
Do you want to get up on the detail with that? I'll hit that one.
Are you able to recover your
cost? Chair Smith. Members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director with the Department of Transportation. Yes, we recover our costs. Those are the amount of money that's actually transferred out of the department is after we have recovered the costs of issuing a license or the permit or license plate.
Thank you.
Did you have the
chair might want to know what it went for, but I'll let that go. Okay, moving into the next one then, the title transfer penalties are, again, just when a penalty payment is being made, that comes into the middle column of $2.4 million. DMV record sales income are the many kinds of records that citizens seek about their own driving record or related records, and we charge a fee for service, and that's the fee shown there, which is dedicated for transportation uses. Other DMV miscellaneous revenue, a very small amount, $94,000, relating to other kinds of very small revenues that come into DMV. Mr. Chair, if I'm going too slow, please just let me know if you want more summary level. Some are kind of nodding like this. So. maybe what I'll do at this point is, okay. Is on the ones that are extremely small, I'll just skip over them pretty fast. The utility permit fees, $4.5 million in the near column. This is a pretty major piece of funds. Right now it's being argued before the Supreme Court, and we're expecting it may be a while before we have a decision on that. For now, we believe, as the AG indicated, that utility fees cannot be used in the highway fund per the Constitution. However, others disagree with that, and if the court comes down saying that the utility fee should be part of the Constitution, that will change it over into the right column. As a constitutionally dedicated fund right now, according to the AG opinion, it's statute. Moving down through some funding sources there, we get to revenue bonds. Obviously, a large revenue source for us will be the bonding of the OTM. And this shows $701 million expected to be bonded in the coming biennium. And then below that are the federal highway reimbursements. There are about six or eight of them listed there, and that's when we're being reimbursed by the Federal Highway Administration for construction, maintenance, and other functions of the program. Below that, and those are all dedicated by federal law, as you can see. On the right after that comes the Motor Carrier Federal Safety Grant, and there are a couple of different kinds of grants shown there, fatality analysis grant, and then a few down below that, which are coming in under federal law to be used for federally approved purposes. And then the Federal Railroad Administration has a payment to us of approximately $15.4 million on the far right column, which is used for specific functions that have been approved by the federal government dealing with track and other improvements. Then the Federal National Highway Traffic Safety Administration makes payments to us for certain educational and enforcement and other functions. Federal Fuels Tax Grant, a small amount of money there. Moving down to the charges for internal services, the $41 million, which is dedicated to transportation purposes, relates to internal service funds or internal services that are provided, whether it's the cost of providing a front-end loader or a dump truck or related parts of the fleet, relates to traffic services and work that are done on traffic lights and signals. Those type of internal services are what are shown there. Charges for services external relates to reimbursables and fuel sales when we sell gas to the state police or have other funds across state agencies and receive a reimbursement for that.
Really quick, we have a question. Senator Johnson.
Mike, I want to go back up to charges for services internal. Are those the charges, for example, that you would assess against rail for keeping their books?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, yes. And I'm sorry about the cold.
So am I. And how have those progressed over time?
How have the charges progressed over time in terms of...
Please tell me they're getting less as you're getting more efficient.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, in charges for internal services are going up slightly, but for the most part, we're still a smaller percentage in terms of information technology or other uses are still smaller than standard practices in most governmental entities. So I'd be happy to show you that kind of information. I should point out that the charges for internal services here, we have assessments and we have charges. When an agency is assessed, in other words, most of the central services functions are assessed rather than an internal charge. So it's a detailed point, but this one does not have most of what central services, how they bill the agency. So this includes most of the things that are actually run as a fee-for-service function.
Mr. Chair, I would just be curious... to take rail, for example, and just show for the last three biennia backwards what that assessment has been, if that's not extraordinarily burdensome to get it.
No, we can do that, Mr. Chair and Senator. I just want to make sure I'm clear in showing that that assessment would be separate from this line, but I'd be happy to do that.
Thanks.
Really quick, back on the federal reimbursement. In round two, can you folks be prepared to explain to the committee how cash flow is managed with reimbursements? Because I assume the state of Oregon is expending cash and then submitting some type of documentation to get a refund.
That's correct.
And so if during round two, you could share with us how you manage.
Happy to do that. It's a very efficient process, Mr. Chair, just to take 15 seconds. We incur the expense, document that expense, send it electronically to the Federal Highway Administration. Within a week, they send us back the check reimbursing us. So the process works pretty quickly, but I'd be happy to get into that more in phase two.
By incur an expense, we receive an invoice from XYZ company for XYZ service.
Correct.
And within a 7-day period of time.
From the time we receive it.
So we're not having to expend cash. We're just managing a process until we receive the cash
from
the federal government.
Correct, with the exception of a few small times when there is some disagreement about documentation.
That's terrific.
Okay, moving on, let's see. We have the highway equipment and property sales would be the next one. When we do have equipment that we sell after completion of its use to the surplus property program or related functions, this is the revenue we receive from that. Other highway revenue, relatively small amount there, and actually the next sizable one is a local government match on highway construction projects where a project is conducted and the local government's pay us, in essence, a reimbursement for work on the project. That's the $93 million, which is dedicated to transportation uses. And the next sizable one is lottery bonds for Connect Oregon, which deals with a program in the governor's recommended budget for lottery funds and would relate to a dedication in the Constitution for lottery uses. And the Transportation Growth Management Program is relatively small, but deals with transportation-related land use issues where there's support through a grant. On the next page, Mr. Chair, is at the top is Department of Revenue cigarette tax revenues, which is $8.6 million. As the members are probably aware, the cigarette tax is split between different functions. Some of it goes to the Department of Human Services. Some of it goes to ODOT. I think about the equivalent to 2 cents goes to ODOT, and that's that revenue source shown there. Lottery funds and statutorily dedicated.
We have a question here. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the Department of Revenue cigarette tax revenue transit STF program, what's the
trend? It's talking about the senior and disabled individuals receive those funds, and it's through the a grant program that's monitored, and the funds are monitored by the federal government, but the actual recipients of that are senior and disabled.
Okay. Can you share with me on that? Last session we dealt with that issue, and my understanding was we also provide a portion of that allocation to our tribal nations. I can't remember if that became
staff. They were redefined to be within the grant program. That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
The next one is a lottery transfer for lottery debt service payments. So that's over on the far right, is dedicated for debt service. And then we have a series of small ones relating to lease and other miscellaneous sales. Then the next partly sizable one is a railroad gross revenue fee, which the railroads pay for regulatory functions from the rail division. Then we have a couple of small ones, several down to the infrastructure bank loan payments, and that's for the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Bank, which is a bank initially dedicated from federal revenues about 1997 and now is used mainly for making loans to local government but can be used for making loans to within ODOT or elsewhere and also can be used for transit functions as well as highway functions.
Really quick, Senator Johnson.
How is that loan fund performing? I recall coming in and testifying in support of it once ages ago. How's it doing?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, better than it used to. There was not much interest in loans back when there was little revenues and little interest in getting a loan, which was slightly better than the market, but not a lot better. Now it's changed quite a bit. There's a lot more interest due to the availability of ATIA, and local governments having some matching money now. So requests are coming in. As a matter of fact, one went to the Oregon Transportation Commission just a couple of days ago. Is on its way to the Transportation Commission now related to a major project, and several of them are coming in with more interest. So we've actually done some internal shifts in order to make sure that the loan fund can be stable and meet the local government demand, which we think is going to continue to go up.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, the last two are over on the far right-hand column, general fund for passenger rail. Of course, I don't need to talk about the flexibility of the general fund. That is the money for passenger rail. And then the cigarette tax funds, which are the $8.6 million, which I referenced before. We should have moved them into one spot. We have one duplication there, Mr. Chair.
Can you share with me really quick on the infrastructure bank loan program, how many FTE administer that?
The infrastructure bank?
Yeah, and perhaps in round two. If you
it's can. Part of one FTE.
It's one, okay. All
right. Mr. Chair, that's the end of the list. I'm happy to go back into some more detailed ones if the members would like or take any questions on the overview.
Any questions? No, but I tell you... Mr. Director and Mr. Marsh, I really appreciate this breakdown. This has been very educational. Thank you.
We know it's been at quite a level of detail, but hopefully it can help in seeing the levels of dedication across the agency.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Where should we go next? Wait for Do you know where you'd like
well,
to
Mr. Chair, I believe where we're going next is we'd like to have an update on where we are on the implementation of the Oregon Transportation Investment Acts.
Perfect.
1, 2, and 3, and Mr. Tindall and I are prepared to do that. I think, again, it gets back to the question of cash flow and how we're doing getting the work out, which is, I think, what you were interested in.
Perfect. Thank you.
I think you should have two written pieces of information, one for me, a memo to you, which just talks about implementation of the Oregon Investment Act, and then one from Doug Tindall, which has a number of more attachments and lists of projects and so on. So I'll go over mine very, very quickly to get it over to Doug, but we do appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk to you about the implementation of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. What we want to do is just give you a first off, make sure you understood the list of projects that are actually being funded by OTA 1, 2, and 3. There is a map, and I apologize, this should have been in color, but we understand the need to not print in color, but there's a map that shows the distribution of the OTA 1, 2, and 3 projects around the state. And I think the important thing to note is they are distributed around the state. And if you want a color version of that, it's a little easier to follow. I'd be glad to get you one. The other thing that we want to do is really get into our commitments and progress on the expectations that were made clear by the legislature in the last session regarding the implementation of OTA 3, which included our commitment for creation of jobs, making sure that we were looking to get Oregon firms and Oregonians employed with the work as part of this funding package, and to increase the utilization of women and minorities, both the individuals and firms in our work. And I think what we also want to do is very quickly give you a little more discussion. I think Senator Berger always has questions about job creation. We wanted to give you a little bit more detail on that so you knew where we were. So very quickly in my memo, what I wanted to remind you is OTA 1 and 2 started it all in 2001. And in 2002, during a special session, when the original authorization was for $400 million worth of bonds that were supported by increases in DMV fees and titling and registration fees, and then another $100 million worth of revenue, and I think, as I mentioned to you before, is as a result of the economy going south and interest rates being reduced, we were able to actually secure another $100 million worth of loan for the same revenues that we had outlined in $400 million in 2001. So that $500 million worth of leverage turned into $672 million total because the cities, counties, and private sector was able to step up and again provide match for those projects. I think what you're very interested in, though, is in the bottom of the page. I just wanted to make you aware that 34% of the projects that were identified and selected are now open to traffic. 41 of them are now under construction, and 25%, the remaining 25% are into the design phase, and we hope to have them out to bid and the construction shortly. What that means is, with very few exceptions, we believe that all of the OTA 1 and OTA 2 projects will be completed and open to traffic by the end of calendar year 2008. And what I also wanted you to make you aware is $216 million, or about 43% of the funds have actually been expended to date. And again, over the next couple of years, you're going to see the majority of those monies going out the door. OTA 3, which was enacted by the 2003 legislative session, made available $2.5 billion worth of investments for transportation here in Oregon. And again, $1.6 billion for local and state bridges, $500 million for modernization, as well as funds for local maintenance, operations, and preservation of their system. And what I always try to remind folks is the OTA 3 maintenance and preservation funding is clearly new revenue, and most of that's going right out to the cities and counties. The modernization dollars, we took some of our existing funds combined with some of the new funds, actually half and half, to come up with $300 million worth of new monies for modernization. The remaining $200 million, it adds up to $500 million, was made available by utilization of a federal funding tool, which is called advanced construction. And when Marsh comes back up and talks about our cash flow, he'll give you a little primer on what that means. But it's essentially using some flexibilities to allow us to get to that $500 million level. And then on the bridge side, we're doing a combination of existing revenues that we dedicated to bridges as well as some new revenues made available by OTIA 3. And I would point out that there is a cheat sheet that's attached also, which I've got one of them here. There, thank you. That looks like this. That essentially gives you the sources of revenue, the expectations of the legislature in 2003, and where the money goes. I think it is important to note that in February of this year, the commission did work with the cities and counties, with our Freight Advisory Committee and ACTS, and determined which bridges on the city and county system were important to freight. We selected those. The bonds were sold. $300 million of the bonds were sold, and within a week, all the money was transferred to the cities and counties for their use. And so we have given them the money to deliver those projects without the usual oversight from the Oregon Department of Transportation. In terms of operations and maintenance, I just want to make sure you understand the magnitude. Over the next 10 years, cities and counties are going to be receiving about $361 million from OTIA 3, new revenues for maintenance, preservation, and operations of their system, and those monies are transmitted to the cities and counties monthly as it comes in. And if you look at what that means, that's the equivalent of 3 cents worth of gas tax with truck weight mile that was dedicated to cities and counties. And I would also point out that no dollars were given to the state or my department for maintenance and preservation. All went to bridges and modernization. You've heard about the five stages of how we're implementing the bridge package. Doug will go over that a little bit more. There's 46 bridges currently under construction. A number of them are now open to traffic. There's another 110 bridges which will be out the door here in the next year and a half, which is about another $500 million. And I think the important thing with our program management firm, they're expecting that we can reduce the length of the overall program from 10 years to 8. And then I would point out that we have made draft recommendations. Our staff has made recommendations with the utilization of all the advisory committees on where to spend that $500 million worth of monies for modernization. You asked questions about that last week, and I believe I provided you in one of the as part of one of the responses a list of the $500 million worth of projects. And if you don't have that, go back and look last week's questions that we responded to, and you'll find a list that shows the projects that were related to jobs, industrial access, dealing with some of the major statewide needs around the state, and also addressing federal earmarks. And I think it's a very important list that you ought to take a look at if you haven't. It's again, has great distribution.
Mr. Chairman. Yes. Director Warner, I want to just make a comment right here that the cities and counties are recipient of badly needed monies. Mm-hmm. And this came about in the discussions of OTIA 3, but all of the OTIA projects have come about as a result of people all getting to the table with legislators and making that a reality. And I think that we can't miss that, because on the policy side, this time, we're looking at ports and rail and airports, and we must have that same spirit that is prevalent and has been prevalent in the OTIA packages. And I know you appreciate that, but I don't want that to be lost on the committee, that it has been through a lot of cooperation, a lot of negotiation, and hard work to bring all of this about, that you can give this kind of report.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, thank you. I wasn't in any way trying to disparage the process. What I was just pointing out is that the monies that came to the state were mainly for improvements to the system versus maintenance and preservation. And that was part of the trade-off and discussion where we came together to be able to have a package that would work, mm-hmm. because there were major portions of this package going to repair state bridges on state highways, but also those were quite important to the overall system. So I agree with you. It is a system, and we need to work together, and that's where I hope we'll be here this year and also in future sessions.
Yeah, a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I in no way meant to imply, I know you appreciate the process, but I wanted to just interject that into this dialogue because I think it's important for all of us to realize that we didn't just suddenly get here where we can have successful projects.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I agree. Just wrapping up very quickly from my end, I think the things that I really want to tell you as the director of the department is we understand the need to come back to you and report to you regularly on how we're doing on the implementation. What's our timelines? What's the expenditure of monies? What are the job creations out there? We also know we need to have early and ongoing involvement with all of our stakeholders. Again, we're doing a number of things on traffic management to make sure that commerce moves, which was another expectation of yours, and that we also needed to do things differently to be able to live up to your expectation. That means, again, outsourcing, putting decisions close to the projects out in the field, and really being a shift from the provider of design and project delivery to being a manager of the system and a manager of consultants and contractors. So this has made a great impact on the department. I think we're doing what you expected us to do. I believe the OTIF program is on track. It's on schedule. I think we're being faithful to the legislative direction. Hopefully you'll believe and agree with us. We think it's properly managed, and we are providing the jobs that I think you all anticipated when it was approved. So that would conclude my introduction.
Senator...
I just want to bear up anecdotally from my own district. It's not just the jobs that you're providing for the projects. It's the jobs that are flowing from the projects. I have a situation in my district where we have a freight mobility route that connects to an OTIA project, and within the next couple of weeks, there'll be the announcement of 100 jobs. And so it's not just the ones you're creating.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, Chair Richardson, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for Highways for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Bruce has kind of framed up the OTIA acts. I'm going to go into a little bit more in-depth discussion. As I do that, I want to talk about how we're doing business differently to make sure that we can deliver on what the dollars that you have given us. The a budget note in 2003 was really focused, as Director Warner mentioned, on getting traffic to move, on making sure that we're expediting the project delivery, getting things out as fast as possible, and making sure that we're creating jobs in Oregon businesses. So we changed our business model substantially from what it had been in the past, which was a centralized organization where our primary function was doing design, to a decentralized function to put decision making out into the regional offices. And while we still do design work and purchase right away to some extent, the majority of the program, almost all of the new work that got added on as a result of OTIA, is done externally through private sector firms.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. A constituent question that comes up all the time that I just want to make sure I understand what you said, Doug, about right-of-way acquisition, that you're allowing consultants to do that now instead of you all doing it?
Chair Richardson, Senator Johnson, yes, that's correct. In a lot of cases, a consultant is buying the right-of-way for us. We still oversee the final payment. The money actually flows to us, but the consultants are doing the negotiation.
And then at the end of the day, who owns the dirt?
Chair Richardson, Senator Johnson, we own the dirt. It is. It becomes part of the public right away.
Thank you.
We call your attention to a strategy of program management, what we refer to as program management, where a firm is on board to ensure that we can get OTIA 3 and all of the bridges delivered and do so in a way that minimizes the impacts of traffic and maximizes the use of Oregon firms and women and minority firms. As Director Warner indicated, OTIA 1 and 2 are well underway. There's a list of projects. It's attachment 1 which is all of the OTIA 1 and 2 projects. I just want to note that this is I want to note that this is noteworthy. I guess if it's noteworthy, noting it would make sense. When this is fairly noteworthy that the legislature gave us the money in 2001, and although it's been 4 years, it's still we have accomplished and completed a number of projects, and that we were going from what I call zero to projects, because at the point that we got the money from the legislature, we had not even identified which projects they would be. So in this a relatively short period of time, we have selected the projects through a public process and already completed several and are under construction on many, with just a few left to go into construction. And we anticipate completion of all of those OTIA 1 and 2 projects by 2008. There might be one or two that will extend into 2009, but the substantial, the great bulk of the work will be completed by 2008. OTIA 3, the bridge projects of which are shown in Attachment 2, is well underway also. We're doing this in stages, and the five stages are shown on the on a color attachment 3, and those stages were selected to provide a corridor approach to opening up highways for freight movement. In the past, we've tended to, when we had limited amounts of funding, we tended to do a worst first sort of approach, where we would look at the condition of various bridges and we'd pick the worst ones and do it first. The drawback to that is that you may be fixing a bridge when just a mile away or several miles away there's another bridge that's still limiting freight movement because it's substandard or structurally deficient. So the approach in OTIA 3 really starts with the project selection, and we looked at those corridors that are on Attachment 3 and said we need to open up all of this corridor to ensure that we have freight movement throughout the corridor. So we're in the Stage 1 bridges have been the primary focus up till now, and we're moving into Stage 2, which is a large number of bridges on the interstate system to ensure north-south and east-west movement. One thing I would also note, that we're working closely with local communities as we deliver these projects to make sure that we're doing things in the right way. And in fact, I should have probably followed this. I know that in middle of January there was a meeting held in the Troutdale area regarding how we were going to go about constructing the bridges or replacing the bridges in the Columbia Gorge Scenic Area. And at the end of that meeting, I'm told that this is a public meeting ended with applause, which not all public meetings end with. So it's a well-received message that we're sending out, I think. Talked about the stages. I'm going to move to jobs. The fourth attachment is the number of jobs that we are sustaining. This is the entire program, not just OTIA 3, and this is the same measure that you saw in our agency key measures when we were discussing performance measures.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Berger.
Your jobs category, though, talks in the future, will create. I'm curious as to what OTIA 1 and 2 have already created.
Chair Smith, Senator Verger, on Attachment 4, you can go back, and we actually have in fiscal year 2003-2004 is where that chart starts.
Okay.
And again, we did not break out OTIA. I'm not sure if I have that. The OTIA expenditures versus the other expenditures, but this is for the whole program. But we did try and back up to some extent in terms of showing how many jobs are already being created and sustained through the OTIA or through all of our funding process.
So okay, let me just be sure now that I understand what you're telling me. What you're saying is that OTIA 1 and 2 did create jobs outside of your department, outside of your regular jobs. OTIA 1 and 2 created jobs.
Chair Smith, Senator Verdure, that's correct. The number of, although not shown differentiated here, but had we not had OTIA 1 and 2, you would not see 8,700 jobs in FY 2003-2004 as shown on Attachment 4.
Okay.
I want to use a little bit of chair prerogative here. I had to step out, so I missed a definition. Under status, can you share with me what the difference is between under construction and under development means?
Chair Smith, under construction would mean that there's actually work going on the ground. Under development would mean that it's in the design phase or the right-of-way acquisition phase that we haven't actually started the construction, haven't broken ground yet. That work?
If that does. Has there been any analysis to take OTIA 1 and OTIA 2 projects that are under development and work with OTIA 3 to determine which is the new priority of combining all of those?
Chair Smith, good question. Good question, because I happen to have the answer to it. We not only looked at combining OTIA 1 and 2 projects with OTIA 3 projects, we also looked at combining our regular STIP projects with OTIA 3 projects, and that was done in a number of cases where, for efficiency, I think where you were headed is for the efficiency of you're already out there doing work, why don't you just do it all together? We did look at that, and we'll continue to look at that as we let OTIA 3 projects in the future.
A follow-up on that. So should this body decide to, at some point, say, fund Connect Oregon, and there were intermodal projects, how would you take those projects and the dollars would be put into those and match those up with OTIA 1, 2, and 3 projects if they're linked together? Would it change priorities?
Chair Smith, it may. If you had a new project that came in that was a multimodal project with a highway element associated with it, we may shift the schedule around a little bit so we can match it up. So the worst case is, and I use the what I've seen happen in some areas where you have city utilities where the road department comes through and does the road, and a year later the water department comes through and tears up the road and does the sewer. So obviously we wouldn't want to do that, and we would look for opportunities which may impact. That is one of the things that impacts our schedule, is those kinds of things. New projects come up and you say, well, it really doesn't make sense for us to run out and do this now when we're going to be back out there in a year or 2 years.
And I assume vice versa on that a project may be scheduled for much further in the future, but there's an urgency behind it that moves it up the schedule.
Yeah, Chair Smith, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Question. Is there any, and I'll just use an example of the Fort C project. I know that's probably not OTIA money, but is there any vehicle for ODOT to fund a project with as local contractors as possible? And how is the different? In that case, I know that the most local contractor was over quite a bit over the bid of the winning contract. But is there any kind of wiggle room in there to award contracts as locally as possible?
Chair Smith, Representative Boone, there's not much. We're pretty much a low bid state, and the concern on the contractor's side is that if you were to offer an incentive that says you have to do it within for Oregon contractors, we'd have a reciprocity issue with other states. Other states would then most likely say, if we were going to give some, for purposes of analysis, some reduction to an Oregon contractor's bid, what would happen is that other states, Washington, would just add on, when they let a contract, they'd add on the same percentage that we're taking off. So if we disadvantage another state's contractors, they're going to disadvantage our contractors. Might help them work in Oregon, doesn't help. Most contractors want the flexibility to work anywhere, not just to be stuck with jobs in Oregon, because there may not always be jobs in Oregon that fit that they're most well-suited to. So long answer, but no, there's not a whole lot of flexibility in our ability to do that.
Just because I know that project as well as I do, I would say that where you have not been able to deviate from the low bid your regulatory flexibility has helped drive that project enormously. And I do know that there have been no questions about using local contractors as appropriate outside of the bid situation, but you have been extremely elastic in interpreting your regulatory prescriptions and have driven that project dramatically.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I hope that we're doing that. I closed with workforce diversity, and there's a laundry list of things here that we're doing, and just let me highlight a couple. We are setting new performance standards for disadvantaged minority and women-owned businesses, upping the percentage from what's been required in the past for OTIA 3 projects, setting expectations for training of minority and women in order to increase the diversity of the workforce overall, and working with community colleges and other state agencies to get a process in place so that we have apprenticeship programs so that training is available so that people can avail themselves of entering the workforce in Oregon.
So how do you reach out to folks on the coast or in eastern Oregon in that effort?
Well, Chair Smith, there's a multitude of ways that we're doing that through outreach. I think you have asked about small business development centers. That will be one way that we're going to look to encourage new participation. Community colleges are a way to look to encourage participation. There's we could give you a whole list of the things that we're trying to do to make sure that we get to as many Oregonians as we can.
While we have you up here, I have one more question on risk analysis as we look at bonded projects. And for some of my colleagues, if this gets political, I apologize in advance. There's quite a potential if we fund Connect Oregon.
What's that?
Stop that. If we fund,
I just said I think you were talking to Representative Richardson.
if we were to fund Connect Oregon, there's quite a potential that we could have OTIA dollars, Connect Oregon dollars, and even STIP dollars into a project, especially on navigation projects, and especially on upriver navigation projects. And the question I have is, how do we as a committee build assurance that we're not going to be putting borrowed money into projects and then knowing that our river system could be litigated and that even greater dollars would be needed to make improvements, perhaps in channel deepening or in building even new channels to get to the channel? How do I know we're not going to have an asset sitting there wasted under the current environment we're dealing with?
Chair Smith, I actually can't answer that question, but I'll tell you, let me just put this in context of some other things that happen on highway projects. And I can't remember who it was that I can't remember if it was this committee or someone else asked me a question about a bridge we built in Nissa. And there was a sugar beet plant that benefited greatly from the reconstruction of the bridge. And the sugar beet plant subsequently went out of business. And so the question that was posed to me was, well, gee, did we waste our investment? Well, the answer in that case is actually, no, you didn't waste your investment, because you have this structure that is there now that and it replaced a structure that needed to be replaced. It was not driven to benefit a particular industry or a particular business in that case. So I think you always run that risk. You could say, what happens if we can't buy gas next summer? Is all of our investment in road projects wasted? Well, without being able to determine what's going to happen in the future, you always run that risk. Anytime you make an investment that's got a long-term payout, is that investment truly going to be used to its full extent?
Well, let's in round two. I think that is an area where I'd like to see more discussion.
Yeah.
Trying to balance the litigation that potentially is before us, and then also the need for connecting intermodal projects throughout the state of Oregon as it relates to our river system.
Good question. Maybe an appropriate discussion for 3 o'clock today when Senate Bill 71 is in Senator Ruger's committee too.
She'll be there. Any other questions? Committee, thank you for indulging me on that question. Where should we go to next?
Mr. Chair, what I think the was one of the main issues that you wanted to get into is, again, just exploring, again, our cash flow over over this next biennium as well as beyond in terms of our expenditures, revenue expenditures, and really tying it back down to our strategies and plans in terms of what we think is an appropriate ending fund balance. And we've done some, provided you some information in a couple ways, and Mr. Marsh, I think, will walk through that, and we'd be glad to answer any questions because I think we've got some pretty solid financial planning that we've been doing to make sure that we can accomplish your expectations.
Mr. Chair, two items. One is the detailed spreadsheet looks like this, and it's titled, should be a front and back for you, estimated versus actual expenditures, 99 through 05 on one side, and then same thing on the other side, but talking about actual revenues. So the other document is this one, which we'll walk through after a brief discussion of the numbers and then discuss the background for our financial planning. So, Mr. Chair, to start with on the spreadsheet, just to give some context, if you look on the estimated versus actual expenditures, 99 to 2005, what this shows is the combined STIP and bond programs is the first category. It shows the state fiscal year, the SFY on the left, 99 through 05, and it shows the state highway fund, other funds, federal funds, ATIA funds, local street bonds, and the total. And we'll talk through reasons and background for ups and downs about where we are, but I want to make sure that you have this as the context. And as you can see, if you look at 99 and the total variance, because we had virtually no bonding occurring back in the 99 time frame, the variance is shown to be $1 million. And if you go from there, it goes up to as high as $228 million for 04. On the basis of what we'll talk about in a few moments, dealing with bonding and other reasons for cash balance and ending balance. On the second one, state fiscal year, state highway fund, other funds, federal funds, total, so just done by the total fund sources, and summarizing those again by total funds shows the kind of variance you see there, varying from the $1 million to $155 million, using those categories.
Really quick, I want to do a quick interruption. I'd like to introduce the committee. As they walk out the door, Gary and Kathy Neal from Boardman, Oregon. Gary's the general manager of the Port of Morrow, and we extend courtesies to you, Gary, and to your wife, Kathy. So, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
No problem. I'm kind of disappointed that they didn't stay for this discussion. Mr. Chair, the third category are the bonded programs, showing the bonds for local streets and the TIAs 1, 2, 3, and again the variance on the far right side showing the amount of change. And on the back side of this document, Mr. Chair, is the estimated versus actual revenues, and again done by those the various categories shown there with variances that show the changes from 99 through 2005. Mr. Chair, what I want to do is emphasize the whys for those and go through that, which is in this presentation here. So I'm happy to come back to other detailed questions about the spreadsheet if the members would like, but maybe we could go through this and give the background to financial planning and whys and hows of expenditures and revenues at ODOT. If you turn past the first page, it has a brief overview there that shows project budgeting and expenditures and then ending cash balance, strategies, and summary. That's what we'll go through this afternoon. The next page shows project budgeting and discusses the funding targets being set every 2 years during the biennial STIP updates, State Transportation Improvement Program. And the targets are set for the last 2 years of a six-year funding cycle. So every time we come into it, we've previously discussed the first 4 years, and the last 2 years are the ones that are adjusted according to what we see coming down the pike. This includes the current four-year STIP plus the two I've referenced, and targets are based on available and projected revenues. We cannot over-program or put funds in that we don't think we're actually going to receive. Project budgets can span many years, and that's one of the challenges in terms of communicating about transportation programs is making it clear that most projects transition more than one biennium. So our budget is done on the basis of what will be paid out in that biennial period for a project. For the group of projects, and it means that there will be, if in a $100 million project, there's going to be some expenditure in 05-07, there's going to be some in 07-09, so one cannot add up the budget and have it equal the amount of projects that ODOT's working on. Project budgets can span many years. They can the funds allocated to the projects are encumbered and cannot be used for other initiatives. In other words, if we have that $100 million project set out now, it's part of an approved budget, and we spend $50 million in 1 year, we would show an ending balance for making payment on that project in the next fiscal year, next biennium. So we encumber the funds and make sure that they're obligated for that project, but they will show as a balance. On the expenditure side, Mr. Chair, moving to the next page, long-term projects pay out differently as the projects move forward. And just using the analogy that we'll show on the next page, we talked about a project that may have a payout in the first year of 30%, 40% in the second year, and 30% in the third year. In this example project, we're assuming a $100 million project, and that would mean it's $30 million, $40 million, $30 million for the years as that project progresses. And the expenditure amounts for each program is done on the basis of the biennial budget. So the expenditure-based budget shows how much we're actually spending in a period. And the total volume for the project is going to be different than the budget in that biennium for a particular project. So the volume is talking about how much is going to be spent only over the period of the entire project. And if we look to the next page, and just to give you some perspective about how that might look, this is assuming a contract amount of $100 million, which is going to be spent each year, and then paid out by year. Going down through the listing, it shows our example project of $30 million the first year, $40 million the second year, and $30 million the third year. It shows how the expenditures would work and how the ending balances would work for our fund.
I'm going to interrupt you really quick. I need a little more background on this.
Yes, Mr.
This is going beyond me, and I'm not sure if the committee's 100% following. What constitutes, just in this scenario, a contract amount? What does contract amount mean?
What we're talking about here, Mr. Chair, is the amount of contracted expenditure for projects. So we've got, in this particular example, it's a series of projects that equal to $100 million.
Okay, I get it now. Okay.
And in the first year, there'd be an expenditure of $30 million towards a particular project. We have a yearly expense then of $30 million if you go straight down the page, and we have a cash balance at the end of the period of $70
million
because we only spent $30 million that year.
And then on that scenario, that ending cash balance of $70 million, that's going to be earning interest and costing the state interest.
It's going to be, and if we have bonded, it will be costing the state some interest, yes, if we bonded. If we have not bonded yet, it is not costing us interest.
How would you pay for that if you hadn't bonded?
If we haven't, like in the end of the current biennium, we have not bonded yet, so we're living on the basis of our revenues that are coming in from OTIA on a monthly basis.
Thank you.
So just, and I don't want to make the committee go through too much detail, but just to maybe go through this exercise to make sure we're all clear. So the ending cash balance is $70 million at the end of the first year. The second year, we're planning on looking at that project expenditures of $100 million again, of new projects at that point. And then we go to a payout for that year of $40 million. And then $30 million for a total of $70 million of yearly expense that goes out in that second year, leaving us with $100 million of ending balance. So if the members are tracking that, we had a $70 million ending balance in the first year. We spent $70 million, acquired $100 million in revenue, and we have a $100 million ending balance. Moving to the next one, we have, again, $100 million that comes in. We spend $100 million on projects during that year because we're well up into OTIA in the example. We have $100 million ending balance still. And then come to year four, where there's no more new revenue coming in. We have the revenue off the prior year and spend it against the projects that are coming to pay out that next year of $70 million, leaving a $30 million ending balance. Again, completing that project then in the next year with that $30 million. So if that can help the members to understand the flow of funds as we look at projects, and the reality that a project is like a bell-shaped curve to some extent, and you put a couple biennia into it, and you're going to be spending part towards that project on one biennia and part in another biennia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate the scenario, and obviously you're trying to keep this as simple as possible for us, and I appreciate that. The issue I'm struggling with as we go through this is trying to figure out the timings of when your cash is going to be needed for expenditure, when you're going to need to spend versus when you're going to need to generate revenue, and the difference in that timing, because that's costing the state of Oregon money.
Mr. Fear, if I could have you hold off on that question for about 5 minutes. We have a chart that I think will hit that pretty well.
Perfect.
And if I'm wrong, we'll go into it in more detail.
Perfect. Thank you.
We turn the page. The next page shows volume versus payout. And the volume means that the amount of total projects as compared to the payout in a particular year. So volume relates to how much is going to be spent on that project, the projects over time, and payout is that payout in a particular biennium. So if we look at the chart, on the left side, you have the $300 million examples where we were going through our example and the amount of money being spent went up to the $100 million level, and then it went down to 70 and down to 30 at the end, showing the five-year progression of payout or contract expenditures, paying the contractors to do the work, as compared to the volume of project that were discussed. Okay. I'm seeing nodding, so I won't take more time. Mr. Chair, moving on to the next one, revenue and expenditure forecast construction program is showing the expectation and forecast for state highway fund as it relates to the current biennium and into the future on the basis of what we know at this point in forecasting the net revenue and expenditures and then ending balance that would accrue considering what we just talked about. In each one of these, you have an ending balance that includes major components for those encumbrances that have been made for expenditures on the projects that have accrued in the period. And when we go to the next chart, it will show, hopefully, the beginning point of the answer to the chair's question, which is the chart that's titled Projected Ending Cash Balance. Now, if the members look at this one, which looks like this, we're all at the same point, this is trying to show that the ending balance impacts as we go through the OTIA program. On the left side is a cash balance in millions of dollars, so that scale on the left shows the 0 to $350 million. The scale on the right is revenue and expenditures in millions of dollars. And the two lines that are going through the period, the slightly lighter line, the gray line, if you will, I'm hoping your eyes can detect that, is the line that relates to the revenues, which are higher at first, and then move up to equate to the expenditures, and then during the latter period, they're actually below the expenditure level. Because we're accruing the funds, we're then spending them off and spending them greater than we're receiving them towards the end of the period. And it also shows in the major the blocks the impact on the ending balance. We begin with a more sizable ending balance, and as time goes on, we get down to our $100 million minimum cash level, which is where we don't want to be any lower than that, and that's our cash management level where we would need to bond or manage our expenditures at that level. After a T is over, we'll have to just manage at that level. Before a T is there, we will allow ourselves to go down to that level and then bond. Money's come back in, we'll spend back down until we get to that level, bond again. And that example is coming up in another couple of charts where we can show how the bonds come in and the monies go out a little bit more explicitly. This next chart, Mr. Chair, is the House Bill 2041 revenue and OTIA bond proceeds, which is there just to show as we move through time how the bond proceeds will go down as we get to the end of the OTIA program in 2011-2013. Now, I hope to probably the most complex chart, but also hopefully the best answer to the Chair's question. This one is titled Expenditures, Bond Proceeds, and Bond Balance. Looks like this. Relatively busy. We'll work our way through it. Moving from the left side, you can see the zero level. So we're coming in talking about having zero bonding back in February of 2002. Right away, we bonded for OTIA 1 and 2 around May of 2002. And you can see that the chart goes up, and the line that is bonding goes up dramatically there, and we have additional revenue. So those vertical blocks are indicating the revenue that we have available, and the revenues go down as we go across the chart to the right. As they go down, actually below zero, as you can see, those blocks go down to the negative. What we're doing there is we're accruing an expenditure that we will reimburse through bonds that we let at the next let date. So we allow ourselves to go into the negative, but recognizing that we are using other fund sources that will replenish those for a short period of time, and then we go back and the next bonding replaces those. So that shows the effect of the bond revenue balance. But the overall question that the chair had is, as we walk our way up this chart, we will go up first on the block that shows the May 02 bonding. Then it's a flat line until you get to another vertical line that says local bridge program. And if the members are seeing that, that's the bonding we did for $300 million that we discussed the other day. We went out directly for the $300 million in bonds, sent those funds, with the exception of a couple of local governments. They're still working their way through some documentation issues. It went directly out to local governments virtually immediately. That is that next spike in the chart. Then it shows being relatively flat in terms of bonding. We may do it some small bonding pieces, but the majority of bonding in terms of a TIA is done again with the expectation of around August of 05. And you see another spike there. And it goes up past the words program expenditures up towards bond proceeds. And you can see that that's another spike where the bond revenues come in. Then we go along flat, no more bonding, until an expectation of July of 06, another spike. So what that's saying is that each one of those times that we bond, we receive the additional revenues. If you look at the more progressive line going forward that says program expenditures, that shows a continuous growth in our expenditures going through the period using those bond proceeds. Mr. Chair, if that wasn't too busy but got at your question, it shows, hopefully will show, the fact that we receive the bonds in, we expend them down, and then bond again, and the bonds revenues go down as we expend them. Each time we come back in at a point where the cash flow will allow us to go to the next period. I didn't want to leave this one unless everyone's comfortable with the explanation. Mr. Chair, should I go on, or did you have a follow-up on that one?
Please go on.
Okay. Moving on to the next chart, then. Just talking about the dynamics that influence ending cash balance. We've mentioned them briefly, but the state revenue is forecast on a semiannual basis. We take those revenue forecasts and project against the revenues against expenditures and make sure we're managing what's happening with the fund. And when we say that state revenue is forecast on a semiannual basis, that's talking about the state highway fund revenue, the general fund's forecast on a quarterly basis. The federal revenue is based on the Transportation Act, which has been basically stalled at the federal level for some time. However, we're using forecasted numbers for where things are out of the President's transportation budget, which is still under debate and discussion in Congress, but we felt there's a good estimate about where things may end up. Moving forward, the further dynamics and issues in terms of project delivery, 80 to 90% of projects start construction in the year that they were planned. That means that there are some projects that do not, due to weather or local design issues or scope changes or a lot of other reasons that can impact project delivery timing. Analyze the state fiscal years 2003 and 2004, and that shows that 9.3% of the program was delayed in 2003. About 20% was delayed in 2004 due to those combination of things we just talked about. And looking forward to the $200 million on the next page, this is talking about the OTIA modernization program. And I'll use as much detail as the members are interested. Suffice to say that through the use of federal financing tools and other strategies, we can move forward $200 million in federal fund expenditures. It's called advanced construction. They allow us to do a one-time movement of funds forward into a near-term expenditure instead of waiting till later without penalty. It's a very beneficial tool that some states have used, and we decided to make use of that. And it means that we can move funds forward for modernization rather than waiting until a later time period. So we can use those funds as well as the $300 million of current revenues to get up to the $500 million level for modernization funds. Other issues on cash balance, managing the revenue changes through the biennial funding allocation process means that we adjust the state revenues based on the six-month forecast and make sure we're constantly reconciling the projections against how we're expending. And on the next page, we've, as Bruce and Doug have talked about in the last period of presentation, we're accelerating project delivery in significant ways through outsourcing, basically totally turning the organization around from the standpoint of how much is outsourced compared to how much is done in-house, decentralizing our management of the program as well as going to design build, which allows for using private sector initiative and ideas on getting projects completed. And then developing a list of projects that could be accelerated and having shelf-ready projects, incorporating that into the what's called the DSTIP or the Developmental State Transportation Improvement Program. And we can't over-program the STIP, but we can program for the amount of revenues that we have and make sure that we're planning ahead to what's going to be coming down the pike in terms of projects. In the past, when we had much less flexibility in terms of revenue, we had much less of a developmental STIP or projects on the shelf and ready. That's our major push now, is to make sure that we have that ready and completed in the developmental planning phase and ready to go to construction. And lastly, the $200 million in ending cash will be expended in the next 4 to 6 years from the standpoint of the modernization funds. Examples discussed here are the Pioneer Mountain Eddyville project and the Redmond Bypass, which go to contract very shortly, as well as other TIA 3 modernization projects that will use the funds. Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that this got you an answer to your question, and I'm open to any other comments or questions. Bottom line is that we use this forecast and revenues to project into the future, to bond when we need to bond, to not bond before that date. There is no bond before its time, and to make sure that we're refining our management tools to use those funding allocation processes from the federal government, which have been very helpful on using state funds as minimally as possible, allowing us to have sometimes more ending balance of state funds because we've moved the federal funds forward due to assistance of the Federal Highway Administration.
Any questions of the committee? I have one committee, if we could go back to the expenditures, bond proceeds, and bond balance page.
Yes.
When you look at the chart from August of 04 to, it looks like, July of 05, there's a negative source of money. Are you using other funds then to make up the skip dollars to make up that reduction?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We're using other highway fund revenues and then tracking that and ensuring that we get reimbursed for those funds through the bonds. So in other words, we are making an expenditure and then reimbursing ourselves with the bond revenues, and that's legal and appropriate to do. And we would do it the first time before we go out for the major bonding that occurs, and from that point forward would manage within the cash balances.
So what's the opportunity cost of not using a bond, releasing a bond, say, in July of 04, and having that cash available and having those other funds out working on projects?
Mr. Chair, basically we're working with contractors on the front end.
couldn't we be getting more bang for the buck if we had reduced or had let those bonds earlier? We could have STIP projects and OTIA projects underway.
Mr. Chair, our logic on the front end of the OTIA program is we're pushing contractors to do things differently. We're starting up a new process. We're moving as fast as we can to get those projects out the door, to get the engineering completed. And the fact is that we can only get so much moving. To put more money out right now would not result in expenditure of the funds because the process is going as fast as it can and getting contracts let, getting the engineering done, and getting things going towards construction. Once we get this first iteration done where folks, we've gotten the contracts let and the marketplace has responded and starting to do the work, then we think that we can inject more bonds in, but the startup phase is you only go as fast as the process will allow it to go. And therefore,
how
we don't see...
How do you explain that to your partners who have been on a STIP list perhaps for a long period of time and were expecting to get moving, but the dollars that perhaps could have gone into those projects is being shifted to a different...
Mr. Chair, let me start, and then I think Bruce can jump in. But there are a couple things. We're working within a system of employee positions that we're flat. We would not add positions to try to get more contracts out or to do other work. So we're working within that flat system to get out as much as we can. Secondly, the marketplace is a new situation for them too. And in terms of folks bidding, folks coming in to do the work, there's a lot that they have to do to respond to a changing situation. So to put a lot more money out on the front end would not have resulted in them being prepared to spend all those funds on the front end.
What I'm struggling with, though, is the STIP process has been an ongoing tool that counties and cities and economic development agencies, the state has used to determine which projects are going to be funded. And for a period of a year or so, dollars that could have been going into STIP projects to fund what our partners view as priorities was really taken away from them.
Maybe I should clarify too, Mr. Chair. This is our expectation of what we're seeing right now in terms of expenditure. If the response back, both in terms of the speed of contract agreements, in terms of expenditures by the engineers as they do the planning and design work for the projects, and then when we start to get to construction, if that changes, then we would move forward the bonding. So that would be quicker than the August of 2005 expectation that we have right now. So we're not delaying any STIP projects by this action.
Mr. Chair, what I hear concern is, and I think it's the right concern or desire, which is to accelerate more projects to get them out the door. If you look at our state transportation improvement program, what we're saying is we're doing pretty well. 80-90% of the projects are going out into the year that they're planned. Some of them slip over to the next year. But we are pushing out a considerable amount more dollars than we have in the past, a lot more than we have in the past. And I think you're saying keep challenging us to move it out further. And that's what we're trying to do. And I'll guarantee you that my staff has that message, and we're trying to figure out ways to accelerate the work as quickly as possible and, frankly, get it done more quickly within the confines of our resources. And I think after you see the OTIA 3 start ramping up for the Phase 2, again, I think people will be going wow around the state because, again, the limited amount of work you've seen on the bridges to date is only about 10% of the overall program that you're going to see in the next 8 years. So there's going to be a considerable amount of work going out there, and I agree our job is to move and accelerate the projects in the state, which is what I think you really want to have us do, because I don't think we're delaying projects. What you're challenging us to do is figure out ways to get it out even more quickly so you can get the money to
do some good. I'm having is do you have the tools to get these out? I mean, the state of Oregon has effectively placed a huge, huge burden and opportunity on your department, and we said, now deal with it. And when I look at this this negative trend, I'm trying to figure out what's the opportunity cost. What is that costing us in terms of projects to our partners, and then also in terms of is there a more efficient way or tools we need to be giving you to make this work? And I don't know the answer. I guess you do. Yeah. And you need to share that with us. So.
Mr. Chair, just a thought on that. If we were to contract more for people who would help us with the contracting, or if we were to hire more employees, which is probably what it would take in order to get more contracts out the door, we could probably get more done on the front end in terms of getting the contracts completed. But the reality is it's a two-part equation. One is for the contractors themselves, the private sector, and how quickly they can step to the plate to do the work that they need to do. At different points, we've been told by folks we're pushing too hard on how fast the contracting process is working. So we want to be careful about trying to work with our partners in order to get things out as quick as it can, but at the same time, not trying to result in pushing, especially contractors who have not done as much bidding because there wasn't as much action before. Now there's a lot of activity. It's just a balancing part of the process to make sure we get it out as fast as it can be.
Perfect. For round two, can you share with the committee the department's policy or the state's policy on the fund shifting portion of using STIP dollars for OTIA projects? Just explain how that works and the authorization.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And I just want that for 101 type background information. Any other questions of the committee? Thank you. where should we go next?
Well, Mr. Chair, if you would like, I think you and staff had some questions about, again, overall the reorganization and what we've done in terms of changing the resources, and I think overall what the cost of that was. And I think you also were interested, which probably jumping ahead to some of the other areas in terms of where are our double fills and work out of class and other things like that, and we're prepared to get into those right now. I'm again turned right back to Mike since he's the one that has those information.
Perfect. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as was discussed by Doug and Bruce, the department did go through a lot of adjustments in realigning its work, and that resulted in changing a lot of people's positions. We went through a lot of personnel discussion with the Department of Human Resources, or the Department of Administrative Services, pardon me, in their Human Resources Division to work through what would happen with those positions. And we, in that process, in the 2003-2005 period, had permanent financing actions that totaled approximately 122 abolishments, 80 positions that were established and reclassed up 108 positions and reclassified down 58 positions. I think the important thing about the numbers is just to communicate the fact that we were taking people who were in the past, many of them were pencil to paper engineers or folks that did a particular job that related to doing design work, and we changed that so that most of that's being contracted out now. So those folks moved from being the pencil to paper engineer to an individual who's managing the system or part of managing the system and managing contracts. And some of those individuals determined that they wanted to make that transition, and some expectations about their development in order to be able to do that new job were laid out. Some decided to make that move and transition and have reclassifications in their positions. Others determined that that wasn't what they wanted to do, and they left the agency, went to the private sector, and now are becoming contractors working on the other side. So a lot of adjustment occurred within the nature of the work that was being done. We used permanent financing to complete that and are still completing elements of that at this time. Before I move on, I wanted to make sure if there are any questions about the concept of permanent financing or of the personnel shifts that occurred in the agency.
I have questions on Representative Richardson. Mr. Chair, Mr. Marsh, I'm looking over these sheets, and I'm looking, I'll go to page 2 of 2. Actually, it's the second packet, so it's like the fourth sheet. It says Highway Division Construction, and we've shifted most of the new contracts construction out of the office, and I'm looking at the number of movement up versus those down, and the vast majority all across the line in various pending contracts are shifting up. And I don't understand. Can you tell me how?
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson. When positions moved from being a pencil to paper engineer or from being another position supporting the doing of individual work, many times the reclassification resulted in a higher level of skill to manage and ensure accountability for others doing that work. So in other words, it was like being a lead work position or being a person who managed others doing it instead of just being an individual who did the work themselves.
Okay. Same person?
Same person sometimes.
Education, same training, changed jobs?
Now, there were some different expectations for those people. Like I mentioned earlier, a lot of folks decided they didn't want to do that and wanted to continue being an engineer, so they left the organization. Those that stayed were ones that their supervisors felt could compete well for a certain type of job, and so there was a competitive process for positions, and folks who currently did the work or did engineering work competed for those. Other folks competed for those, and the position was given to an individual, and then that person was determined to be the best person qualified to do that work. And there was many times an expectation of a certain amount of training. Sometimes the training that to be done in order to move from, in essence, doing the work themselves to supervising others required a different version of understanding of contracts and other types of training. So those training commitments occurred in order to get the people up to speed and make sure that they could do the work. Now, I don't want to say that every single position ended up with an ODOT employee in it. There were people that were hired from outside also.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, I think also help Representative Richardson. There is a difference between somebody's classification of work they're doing, because people did change jobs. The people are doing different jobs than they were doing before. And in some cases, they had the right qualifications to be able to compete in fellows positions. In some cases, they didn't. And so it was a competitive process, as Mr. Marsh put out, to get the right people in the right spot. So there's a number of people who are doing different jobs now than they did before the reorganization was initiated and completed.
And, Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, not only in different jobs, but most of the time in a different place. They're out now working at a technical center in a region and actually working with the contractors to get that work done, instead of working in Salem as a design engineer doing preparatory work for a contract. Now they're out actually working with contractors and on-site managing a series of contracts that were occurring.
Can you share with the committee how many employees are in the construction portion of the highway division? Total number of employees?
I believe it was about 1,300, wasn't it? 1,225. Mr. Chair, I don't want to take the members through more than you wish. This series of pages shows the reclassification packages that went forward. Representative Richardson had started on one of those, and it shows the other packages for the other divisions, as well as a different summary showing the packages as of February 2005.
The committee has in a very basic way is if we're now contracting out the work, what happened to the people who previously were doing the work? And that's a very simplistic way of putting it.
Yeah. Maybe I can categorize it into three elements, Mr. Chair. Some of them left. The job and the change of the job was not to their liking. They determined that they wanted to continue being an engineer doing the work that they used to do, didn't want to supervise contracts, didn't want to change the job, didn't want to get involved in working with contractors in a different way. So they left the organization to either hang out their own shingle or work for someone else. That's one group. A second group determined that they wanted to stay and competed for the jobs that were out there, two different kinds of jobs that were out there, one that would relate very closely to the kind of job that they're doing, but a lot of folks were competing for those in terms of the continuation of actual ODOT design work. And some folks were determined to not be able to stay in the job doing the design kind of work, so that some stayed for that. Some then, after they didn't have the opportunity to stay in their design kind of work, went for the change and have a different job. Totally different job. As part of the process, we had about 200 position changes that related to people doing different kinds of work because of our expectation of outsourcing more. And it's one person who is moving their job through a competitive process to be hired into another job in the organization. So they left one job with one level of pay and went to another job. So those are the three basic ways that shifts occurred. And if that helps, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that. But I think Doug would like to maybe add something a bit if he could.
Sure. Terrific.
Chair Smith, Doug Tindall again. If you look at the numbers, we talk about over 1,200 FTE in the construction program. And you look at these numbers here, you're talking about around 100 positions that were reclassed up or established new. So the majority of the positions in construction are still doing the same kind of work. I know this is a little confusing when we talk about the order of magnitude of how much we're contracting out, but we are contracting out primarily the new work. Okay, so we're still continuing to do our old work. We had this 100 and something positions that we needed to flex around so that we could manage the contractors, but it's out of 1,200 positions, moving 100 and whatever this is, 120 or so, is not a significant move to match our reorganization.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Richard, I can help. I mean, the bottom line is we are still delivering a significant amount of projects with in-house resources. It just happens we're increasing dramatically the amount of work going out the door utilizing the private sector. So we had to cut back or reduce slightly the amount of work being done inside to free up the resources and the FTEs to essentially start managing contractors to put out this large
amount of new work that's going to occur over the next 8 years.
Well,
and
I
the majority.
I think adding to that, if I'm getting it correctly, it's important for the committee to understand you have received a large influx of cash and have been directed to do new projects.
Right.
That doesn't take away from previous projects, but you have new and additional ones, and you're taking staff, shifting them, and then contracting out the remaining portions of the work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct, yes.
And that's an important point, just maybe to add on that. So if our program was at this level and we had enough positions to do this level and the program doubles, but we have still the same number of employees, this whole difference here is being done by outsourced folks. So we have enough work to continue the folks actively employed on a strong program, but the additional amounts being done by the contractors.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Marsha, when it says management, would you define management? Because we talked about project managers as compared to design engineers, but then in large organizations, often there is, if you have this many workers, you have a new manager. And so what I'd like to know is how many of these positions are not producing, are not supervising projects, but are now supervising staff people?
Mr. Chair, let me answer the first part first. A management position is someone who supervises individuals, or a management service can also be someone who's in a community of interest with management service. In other words, although they may not supervise people, the nature of the work deals with either collective bargaining or personnel issues or things that are part of the community of interest of management. So that's the definition of managers, either supervising or part of that community of interest to be called management. The second part of your question, Representative Richardson dealt with the number of management folks that were adjusted here. And if you look at the construction list on the page we were addressing earlier, page 2 of 2, headed by Highway Division 2003-2005, if you look at the total there, you can see the total management positions that were up were 14, non-management 35. Non-management to management and management to non-management. The total comes out to 54. The main categories are those two. Management of 14 and non-management of 35, if that answers your question in the construction area, and I can go through the others if you like.
Maybe I was still waiting for the end. When you shifted to the construction and you said, yes, management is 14, non-management is 35, but I wasn't real clear on what their duties were. And are these project people, project managers, do you have a formula for staff, people who take care of personnel issues and collective bargaining issues and those kinds of things, which I really don't think are a huge issue, you know, when you're talking about a whole organization. But I'm just trying to get a sense on how large the bureaucracy grew from people that are not managing projects or actually working on getting things done that are administrative.
Okay. Mr. Chair, let me just answer the question in context, and maybe Doug wants to come up to talk about specifics. The movement that occurred, for the most part, was taking people from Salem and moving them to technical centers in the field. So as we established those technical centers in the five regions, there were some management positions that needed to be established. And so we moved from having a support structure hierarchy in Salem to having it split apart and having a structure that existed in each one of the regions, but allowed us to be closer to the customer and be able to get the work done more efficiently. But it did result in smaller units to some extent in the field, but at the same time getting the work done more efficiently. So those technical center managers were created, as well as other positions were created in the field to make sure that we had coverage on the different categories of work that were occurring.
Before we go further, how many regional or technical managers out in the field were created?
As I recall, we have five technical centers, and each one of the technical centers, I believe, had a structure of four managers reporting to the technical manager.
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer your question in specific, but when we decentralized, we took managers and workers out of Salem and sent them to regional offices. So I don't know that there's necessarily, I had never thought of it in the way you're asking it, necessarily an increase in the number of managers. I don't think our span of control changed much through the
reorganization. The intention of the reorganization was not to become, or to become less bureaucratic, not to become more bureaucratic, by putting people out there that could do the work while they were on the ground and not have to send it into Salem was the concept. But I don't know that I'd ever thought of it in the sense of changing a bureaucracy. We just sent positions that were in Salem, management and non-management, out into the field.
Okay. My original question was, can you give me a sense of how many additional manager positions were created? Because I don't know if in ODOT you base it on numbers. Like DHS, they've got, you know, so many workers, you get a manager, and those kinds of things. So I'm looking on page 2 of 2 of the first packet, and it says that management, there's 31, non-management, there's now 72 that's moved up. So you had 72 positions move up in non-management and 31 positions move up in the management, and I didn't know what management means when you're not in the construction phase.
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, I think I understand your question. And if you look over in those next column, there's actually a net, and we use the same definition of management that DHS does. The classification system in the state is essentially the same regardless of what agency you're in. So when we say manage for the purposes of this classification, when we say management, we mean someone that's in a management classification, not necessarily someone that's managing a contractor. So our definition would be exactly the same, and you can see the net established and the up and down movement in those last two columns of that page that you're looking at. So I read that to say that the net result was we established 10 management people.
Okay, and just as a final follow-up then, you said it's the same across the state, so it has nothing to do with what is needed for the management of a project, depending on the project, but that it's based on how many workers you have underneath.
Yeah, Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, that's correct. There may be a non-management employee, in other words, a person who's not in a management classification that's managing a contract. That's not the dividing line. The dividing line is whether you're managing ODOT staff, not, or whether you're managing state staff, not whether you're managing a contract.
Okay, thank you.
I guess you have something.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Christina Shear for the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. Doug's correct. The management service classification or designation is irrespective of the individual duties assigned by agency. So it is truly based on whether or not the person is functioning in a management capacity in terms of supervisory terms or confidentiality. Or in this, I liked Mike's term, and I can't remember what it is. Community of interest. Thank you very much. So the project managers that ODOT employs to manage contracts are not, according to HRSD classifications, management service.
Right.
They may be project managers, but they are not management service employees.
Can I ask about Rachel?
Does that help?
Sure. Why don't we take my last question here?
Following question. It does help. Can you tell me what the ratio is of manager to staff?
Not off the top of my head, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, but we can certainly provide that to you.
Would you? I'm really interested in how that's done. Thank you very much.
Committee, we're just a few minutes away from 3 p.m., and I know the director and his staff need to be over at another hearing, and so we're going to wrap this up early. We do, once again, have the chair of the commission in the room with us, and I'd like to extend greetings to you. Thank you for being here. Mike and Doug and Mr. Director, I want you to know this has been very, very good. Truly appreciate the information you've provided to us. It's been very informative, and we look forward to working with you here in the short interim between now and round two. I think on the reclassification issue, I think that's something that perhaps we'll need to spend a little more time on between now and round two, just so we have a little more clarification on that. But I think that's something we can work through. Are there any other questions from the committee? Great job, and we appreciate it. And the good news is in 2 years, you can re-educate a new committee. So with that said, we're going to adjourn for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That made him feel good.